This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, over the past year, the movement for Black Lives has brought together over 50 organizations to articulate a common vision for change.
From Occupy to Black Lives Matter, the movement is converging, and this is the latest and greatest example of that.
We'll talk about a recent congressional decision approving the sale of cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia.
This is a country that beheads people for sorcery, and the American military-industrial complex in the last several years has sold them $140 billion worth of arms.
Noted biographer Professor Gene Edward Smith talks about his recent biography on George W. Bush.
He was an unprepared, stubborn, feckless commander-in-chief. He had a short attention span. He was untraveled, untutored, unversed. Bush thrived on making a show of his decisiveness.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In response to ongoing violence by police against Black communities across the nation, more than 50 organizations have come together to articulate a common vision and agenda for change. The Movement for Black Lives has issued a detailed and thorough call to end the war against Black people that spans such topics as criminalization, imprisonment and killings, not only of Black individuals, but all oppressed communities. Broad areas for reform include economic justice, reparations, invest-divest, community control, and political power. Joining us to talk about this new platform is Donna Murch. She's professor of history at Rutgers University and author of Living for the City, Migration, Education, and the Rise of the Black Panther Party, as well as the forthcoming 2017 book, Asada Taught Me, State Violence, Mass Incarceration, and the Movement for Black Lives by Haymarket Press. Donna Murch, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's my pleasure.
The Movement for Black Lives is a collective that's been in the works for the past year. Tell us a bit about its genesis.
Well, you know, there was a convening in August 2015 where you had a bunch of sponsoring organizations that came together, and I didn't attend it, but I was following it closely, and it was the attempt to try to create a national formation, and Cleveland was chosen because of its importance with the local movement there. So it's marked this kind of transformation of going from these organizations and individual struggles, also individual researchers and activists involved in it, to try to create a national formation or a united front.
They've issued a truly impressive list of demands that incorporate social and justice and criminal justice issues, economic issues, really that also encompass the experience of women, Muslim, formerly incarcerated persons, many others. Talk a bit about how these demands are framed. They're in different categories.
That's right. So you essentially have a platform that's broken down into six major sets of demands. So they're framed by ending the war on Black people, which is the first and really the longest and most detailed platform. And I think that that's the one where you see really the movements against the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration, police state, the carceral state, all these different ways that people talk about the war on Black people, and I would also say Black and brown people. So that's the first demand in the platform. And what's amazing about it is that they break it down into all these different subgroups. So you have the question of the war on drugs, of juvenile incarceration, of the whole system of extraction and profiting from bail, court fees, the specific ways that these punishment campaigns have affected women, trans people, queer people. And the thing I was really, really struck by, and it's something that we might talk about because it runs throughout the platform, is that they really give an economic life to racism. So they're very interested in these ways that essentially class and money, how that intersects with state violence, and in turn how that's built on a racial regime. So that's one of the most powerful things, but that's only the first demand. That in itself is an amazing, that section is amazing if you want to get a kind of summary of the most present and important issues for how to fight mass incarceration. But they go on to deal with reparations, invest, divest, which I'll talk about more in a minute, economic justice, community control, and political power. So it's a really broad platform, I would argue, for social transformation. One of the things that's really striking in this document is that it brings together prison abolition, which is essentially a movement that it dates back in time, but with the formation of critical resistance in 1998, and you had Angela Davis, Ruthie Gilmore, and others who really brought together this idea that following the abolitionist movement against slavery, that we need an abolitionist movement against the criminal justice system in the United States, against prisons, policing, and jails. So it weds a prison abolitionist perspective, but with a really detailed policy perspective. And that's what I thought was most remarkable about it. So it often will, in terms of the way the document looks, it talks about the specific targets, and it often will break it down from municipal, state, federal, and then also the difference between judicial and legislative. So that part, it has a really meaty, detailed policy platform with ideas about how people might intervene and organize on the local level. I would also say, in terms of the overall document, it's a wonderful use of research. So I think it's a place where you see kind of the use of political education, really, as this is a document that is, I'm a scholar of mass incarceration, and I have learned so much from reading it, and I feel like I've honestly just plumbed the surface of it, because there's a lot to really be studied. That's how detailed the research is, and the very specific process and policy prescriptions.
Now, in these categories, you mentioned the different local, state, federal levels and policy concerns. Are there specific requests for, say, legislative action, or is it left more to the reader sort of as a guide with ideas about how to engage in activism?
There's a lot of specifics. One of the things that they do is, in some cases, they have model legislation. So they look at where states have gone in and done things like, for example, abolish the death penalty. So they give examples of specific legislation. There's also the drafting of model legislation. It varies by individual policy draft, but you really do have a lot of specifics. One thing that I noticed, I posted this in social media, and immediately someone responded and said, well, ending the war on Black lives would be good, but how about something concrete like a civilian oversight board? And not only does this discuss that in detail, it doesn't just talk about a civilian review board. It gives lots of examples of different kinds of civilian review boards. I think that's a remarkable thing about it. In reading this document, I became really curious about the history of how it was drafted, because I feel like what they've done is not only create a collective or united front of different kinds of organizations, but it feels to me like they brought together the experts in each specific policy area, and it really does reflect that. I recently have written something on the system of extraction. It was a piece called Paying for Punishment. So I've been thinking about that a lot, about the way the criminal justice system makes money. And one of the policy platforms that stood out to me very much was their call for the abolition of bail, for example. That one stood out to me especially because I've been thinking about these issues a lot. And they go into the details about the kind of, how could I put this, the class violence of bail, that I think the example was that 70% of women make an average of $12,000 a year before arrest. So a $1,000 bail essentially is a de facto jail sentence. And then they go on to talk about how this actually creates an incredible cost for the state. So because people can't pay for bail, and overwhelmingly the people being incarcerated are indigent, and they break down the difference in gender. So women are making roughly a third less than men. So that's an example of the gender analysis, or a very specific thing about how women are affected by bail. So there's this wonderful detailed social science data that's used to back up specific policy prescriptions. But I would say it's very concrete. It's one of the most concrete organizing documents I've ever seen.
And is there attribution to the various contributors and experts?
Well, what they have is at the end of each policy draft, they list the people that worked on it. So you do have the specific organizations. In some cases, you have academics and other researchers who are involved.
Donna, when I first glanced at it before I dug into it, I thought, this is thrilling. This brought me back to the days of Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity, that organization's program. And then, of course, later came the 10-point program of the Black Panther Party, about which you know something. And I wanted you to contrast the two earlier efforts with what we have now.
Well, you know, what's so interesting is that in many ways, this current movement, and certainly Black Lives Matter does this, I think, most explicitly, but BYP 100, they draw their iconography from the Panthers. So the most common is the invocation of Assata Shakur, who was a revolutionary from New Jersey, who became part of the New York Black Panther Party, and then ultimately was arrested, was charged with capital murder, was broken out of prison, which is an amazing thing. She herself, in a way, is an emblem of resistance. I've always thought Assata has become an emblem because she's free and living in Cuba. So they explicitly link to the Panthers, and I think that there are things that they share with the Panthers. The thing I would say they share most explicitly is this kind of wedding of socialism to a project of fighting state violence. So that part, I think, and this is where we see the evolution of the organizing, I think, that's gone on. This, to me, gives real legs. In the very beginning, and I want to disaggregate always the Black Lives Matter network from the other organizations that came together, because I think there's always been more ideological diversity. But when the kind of the network Black Lives Matter came together, there wasn't a lot of economic discussion. You know, there was a lot of talk about the end of killing of black people, but it's something that, and we saw this in the debate about what happened at Netroots, with the debate over Bernie Sanders, there was really a very strong program about trying to stop state violence, but not as much about economics. And so one of the things I would say is that this document really reflects a year of kind of the auguring of the movement and its real integration with all the different kinds of people and, I'd say, long-term organizing that's been going on. What you begin to see in this document is a coming together of long-term prison abolitionists, of all the different organizations all over the country that have been fighting against all different aspects of police state mass incarceration, and then also fighting for economic justice and redistribution. So I think that that kind of very special bringing together of redistributive agenda and fighting state violence reflects the Panthers. One thing that I think is a little bit different is the ideological formation. So the Panthers believed in all black organizations, and in that sense, this movement follows very much in that tradition. But I think that there was a sense of a general agenda that was seen as the points of unity with other groups. And I think there are places in the document where you can see this, you know, the call to other oppressed people. But I think that there has been an ideological shift. I think that there is a much more singular focus on the specific economic consequences of these state practices on black people. Whereas the Panthers, you know, if you go back and you look at their documents, there's really a great deal of invocation of using ideas of internal colonization, talking about the effect on the Native American population. You know, the kind of rainbow vision of the Panthers is distinct. So that's where I think these are different traditions of black radicalism. But I am struck by that, and that's something that we might reflect on why that's happened.
Was there another section that particularly stood out to you?
I was just really amazed by the invest, divest section, which I loved it for its specifically for its framing. So rather than simply talking about divesting and abolishing all these different types of criminalization, containment, incarceration, it's really a vision for how to divest from that. Robin Kelly calls it a peace dividend, and then how to reinvest that in these community institutions that provide for long-term life, public health, access to education. So I think that it's important because one of the criticisms of the movement has been is that we need a program for how to move forward, not just a program for what we want to stop. So I think that it's that emphasis on life, right? The movement for black lives. And what I see in Invest Divest is really this attempt to kind of revision what government is and to figure out what people essentially deserve in order to have long and meaningful lives. So that reinvest, invest, divest, investing in people's lives, I think is very compelling.
Speaking of investing, I know that during the Occupy movement, several philanthropists, often without credit, came forward to provide support. Is it your understanding that there's been interest in assisting this movement as well?
There has. And that's where I, you know, this is something that really requires, I think, more. We need to spend a lot of time talking about this document. It struck me as it would be a great thing to have as a study group, to have study groups meet and form around it, to figure out also how to adapt specific parts of the document to our own local situations. So, for example, I think it's 13 states that don't have the death penalty, but a significant number that do, and they provide very specific prescriptions about how to fight the death penalty. The question of philanthropy is, I think, one of the most pressing facing this movement. And it was true of the Black Power movement in the 1970s, too. There have been critical accounts that have been written about how essentially philanthropy mainstreamed the movement and in many ways set up an organizing model in which you moved from grassroots, unpaid activists to people that became paid organizers. So, I mean, people need to have access to resources. So it's not that I'm saying that people that do political work shouldn't have access to resources. Especially in Ferguson, you saw the brutality of that because you had all these young people that had been involved in protest every day, and you had not-for-profits that were coming in from outside with paid organizers who essentially became involved in Ferguson, but this was a movement that they themselves had created at a local level in a community that's profoundly deprived of resources. So I think that there's a real question there about what do you do, especially if you have poor and working class people involved in a movement. They suffer real consequences for this movement. I've seen it in Ferguson, being incarcerated, people lose their jobs, people lose their homes. There's really a brutal story on the ground in Ferguson, and I'm sure it's similar in Baltimore. So on the one hand, there's this need of people. On the other hand, when you have these organizations that come in and these foundations and they provide money, I think that necessarily shifts the nature of the type of activism that's being done. So, for example, when I was in Los Angeles, for long-term activists, many of them had refused to take grants because they were concerned that what happens is that you create a not-for-profit and then you become most concerned about getting other grants. So not only that the scope of your organization can be shaped by what the grants will allow, but simply the process of constantly applying for funding, which by its nature forces you to hire people that can write grants. So I think it can often shift the class composition of organizations, and that's essentially what's happened with not-for-profits. So I think there's some difficult questions to ask about this. There are foundations that do good. I know that's not a very popular position to say on left radio, but, you know, there are foundations I've seen that have funded really important work. But I think it's worth having a discussion about that, about whether to accept money and what the consequences of that are.
Important analysis.
Yeah, no, I mean, money comes with strings very often. Sometimes those strings are elastic and long. But nonetheless, I think you have to be very conscious about that because it could be corrupting. What are the next steps for the Movement for Black Lives?
Well, I feel that the Movement for Black Lives has given us such a huge organizing document. In some ways, if this was used in the right way, this is a blueprint for how people can mobilize both at the local and the national level. So I think in some ways they've given us this amazing gift. We were saying after looking at the entire thing online and printing it out, it's over 200 pages. So I think one of the next steps is for also people to take this really seriously and to sit down and figure out how to use it to mobilize at the local, state, and national level. I think my point of view is that because so much of the incarceration system takes place at the state level, that I think that local and state organizing is very important. It's our state prisons that have the largest number of people in prison. On the other hand, one of the things this platform also done that is remarkable is has a detailed description about immigration, the need for changes to the immigration system, and dealing with immigrant detention and immigrant criminalization, which takes place at largely at the federal level. So I think that we all have to kind of digest this platform, and I think that it is useful to many different types of groups. It was, you know, I think that they've produced a document that would have been very useful to the Occupy movement. I would like to see other groups take up this platform and figure out how to adapt it to their own organizing needs. I, as a scholar, feel that I have to sit down and really study this, because there's so much, not only information, but ideas in each policy brief about how to mobilize against a very specific issue. And one of the things that we're facing with mass incarceration is that there's so many different parts to the system. There's probation, parole, jails, juvenile facilities, prison to school pipeline, state prisons, federal prisons, immigrant detention, gang injunctions. You know, there are so many different kinds of policies that are all nestled under this rubric called mass incarceration or the new Jim Crow. So I think that this material really needs to be absorbed, and we have kind of a blueprint for a movement. It's very interesting because I haven't seen a document like this for the 1960s. You know, one of the things that's kind of interesting about that is that it is quite, you had newspapers that were produced. The Black Panther Party, for example, produced a newspaper every week and contained within the newspaper. And they've taken the structure of this document with needs and demands from the Black Panther Party platform. So I think that that comparison makes sense. But we do have an interesting wedding of different forms. So it feels like some of the not-for-profits, I'd say progressive, not-for-profits have been involved in the drafting of this organization. That's my feeling. I saw the Center for Popular Democracy under a number of the different policy briefs, as well as academics. So I think that they've given us really an agenda about how to go about this in very specific ways all over the country.
Historically, there's been various revolutionary programs that go all the way back to the middle of the 19th century. And that this draft that we've been discussing is the latest reiteration of a revolutionary program. The shortest, sweetest one was the one that revolutionary socialists in the Russian Revolution raised, and that was bread, peace, and land. But there were many others for the last 150 years. Donna, it's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Do you have any final thoughts for us?
I just want to respond to the last comment. What's interesting, though, is that you have a revolutionary platform, but then you have policy briefs about how to go about it. That's really the part that surprises me about this, is that it's wedding a revolutionary platform of abolition to very specific, targeted policy reform, and with recommendations for judicial reform and policy change. So it's something that reminds me more of what you would see from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. That's what I think that's what's interesting about this document, is that it's really not a polemic. It has a section that has call for revolutionary changes, but a lot of it is this incredibly dense policy recommendations, and not just policy in the sense of sitting in a closed room, but what the policies that should be targeted are, and then the process for how to challenge them. And it's drawing on a tradition that activists, I think, have been using a lot. I became familiar with it through Ferguson, but it's power mapping. So where you try to target what specific person, organization, institution is the primary agent for a specific policy, and then how the process of how you challenge that. That's what I think is interesting about it. There's a broad dialogue that's going on here between a kind of revolutionary transformative movement and then something that's like coming out of very carefully drafted thought about how the state works.
Well, you can struggle for reforms, and we are for reforms, but you can struggle for them in a revolutionary kind of way. And I think that's what people are going to get when they read this document. You can get it online, Movement for Black Lives. Just punch it in and print it out.
Donna Murch, as usual, it's been a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, I always love coming on Law and Disorder.
Last month, Congress narrowly approved the sale of cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia. Illegal under U.S. law and manufactured by General Dynamics Corporation, they are being used in the Saudi war against Yemen and are dropped on civilians. Now, a second arms sale, this one involving tanks and armored personnel carriers, is up for congressional approval. Several peace groups, including Human Rights Watch, have come out against it. A recent New York Times editorial stated that, quote, Congress should put the arms sale on hold, and President Obama should quietly inform Riyadh that the United States will withdraw crucial assistance if the Saudis do not stop targeting civilians and agree to negotiate peace. The Saudi Arabian monarchy has been a longtime ally of the United States and provides a significant amount of oil, as well as being a major purchaser of American corporate-made weapons. We speak with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., on the role of Saudi Arabia in the Middle East and on current developments with its use of American-made weapons on its war in Yemen.
Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you both.
Well, it's great to have you back. There's an arms deal pending with Saudi Arabia that Heidi and I would like to talk to you about. Last month, the United States, actually General Dynamics Corporation, one of the military industrial complex outfits, sold Saudi Arabia cluster bombs that are used on their anti-personnel bombs. And now there's an arms deal pending that we wanted to ask you about. What's happening with it?
Well, the arms deal that's pending right now is mainly, it's about $1.5 billion worth of tanks and armored personnel carriers. And the thing about this deal, and also the deal last month that included the cluster bombs and the earlier deals that have dealt with bombers and smart bombs and guided missiles and planes, is that they're all part of a set of arms deals that the U.S. has been trying to arrange over time. According to the great analyst of arms deals, Bill Hartung, he found that in the first 6 years of the Obama administration, agreements for $190 billion worth of weapons and training for Saudi Arabia were kind of in the negotiation process. They didn't all get finished, but they're all kind of in the works. And in this, from last year through this year, there's been about another $22 billion, which includes the new $1.5 billion of tanks and armored personnel carriers, but also all kinds of other armaments that are being used right now by the Saudis, particularly in Yemen, where overwhelmingly the main victims of these weapons, particularly things like cluster bombs, are Yemeni civilians, many of them children. Thousands of people have been killed by the Saudi-led coalition. The U.S. has on occasion said a word or two about, oh, isn't it too bad there's so many civilian casualties, but has done nothing to actually put any pressure on the Saudis to stop its bombing, to stop the bombing that is continuing to go after civilians in Yemen. So it's a very difficult time because there's a set of tensions between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia on some political issues, but at the end of the day, on the strategic side, there's just no indication that the Obama administration or any before him have been prepared to actually bring some pressure to bear on the Saudis to stop their violations of international law being carried out with our weapons. And one result, of course, is that in a poll that was taken in Yemen, I guess about a year ago, that what they found was that, actually not even a year ago, it was earlier this year, 82% of Yemenis now view the United States as their enemy. Not surprising, because they know where these weapons come from that are wreaking such havoc on Yemeni civilians.
Phyllis, can you talk a bit about the legality of these actual weapons? Didn't Leahy pass a law finding them problematic?
Yeah, there is something called the Leahy Law. But like most laws, it only works when somebody tries to enforce it. The Leahy Law basically says that the U.S. is not allowed to sell weapons to any particular unit. It's not even a prohibition on sending weapons to any country, but specific units of any specific army that have been known to carry out a pattern and practice of human rights violations. Now, by those standards, pretty much the entire Air Force of Saudi Arabia and a bunch more are consistently carrying out human rights violations. But there's nobody yet prepared to bring it up under the terms of the Leahy Law. There are some efforts in Congress right now, there's been a lot of pressure on members of Congress, and a few of them are responding, and they're drafting letters, and there's some efforts at a campaign to prevent a vote on authorizing this most recent $1.5 billion worth of tanks and armored personnel carriers. But nobody has been raising the Leahy Law and said it's actually a violation of our own laws to be allowing these arms sales at a time when the United Nations has said that the Saudi-led coalition is overwhelmingly responsible for the civilian casualties in Yemen. The U.S. has actually called for greater Saudi concern about civilian casualties, but there has been no actual implementation. It's similar in some ways to the tensions between the Obama administration and the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, over settlements, where there's this constant refrain of, the settlements are not helpful, the settlements are an obstacle to peace, we wish you would stop building settlements, but it's never linked to any real pressure, which would mean ending or cutting back on the $3.1 billion a year in military aid to Israel, or stopping the history of the U.S. protecting Israel at the United Nations. And when you have no connection between what you say you don't like and what you're doing to help that other country, the criticisms don't really mean very much. The same is true with the Saudis.
And it's true that General Dynamics Corporation is manufacturing these weapons, isn't it?
Well, it's manufacturing the cluster bombs, which have a particular issue of legality. For many parts of the world, cluster bombs are illegal. There's an international covenant against the use of cluster bombs because they target civilians. The U.S. has not signed on to that international covenant. And unfortunately, for the U.S., the view is, hey, we're the most powerful country in the world, so if we don't want to sign a particular restriction on a particular weapon, we just won't sign it, and we will ignore the fact that every other country in the world is expected to abide by it, even if they don't sign it.
In the old days, Saudi Arabia supplied much of the oil that the United States needed, but that's no longer the truth. So is it true now that the importance of Saudi Arabia is that it's a purchaser of weapons more than just a supplier of oil?
Well, I think the arms sales has become the most important part of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. But it would be a mistake, I think, to take the question of oil off the table. It's different than it used to be. As you say, Michael, the U.S. used to rely on enormous amounts of oil being directly imported to the U.S. from Saudi Arabia. That's no longer the case, partly because there's less oil being imported, because we're using less oil, finally, with the understanding of how damaging fossil fuels are, but also because the unfortunate part, the U.S. is producing far more oil, so it doesn't need to import as much oil as it used to. And starting in about 2010, the oil that the U.S. does import comes more from Africa than it does from all of the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia. What's still very important, though, about Saudi oil is that the U.S. plays a major role as the strategic or military defender of the oil routes, the oil pipelines, the shipping, all of the things necessary to make sure that U.S. allies elsewhere in the world, particularly in Asia, have continued access to Saudi oil. So that's still a very important part of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. The U.S., you know, sells arms to Saudi Arabia, maintains at least one base, military base inside Saudi Arabia, has this long-standing political relationship with it, doesn't do much except once in a while murmur something about human rights. So for all of those reasons, the oil ties are still strategic. You know, it's true that there have been different positions, even from President Obama, back in 2002, in a famous speech that he was making against the war in Iraq. He spoke about Saudi Arabia as well as Egypt under Hosni Mubarak as our so-called allies in the Middle East. And he said at that time, he said a fascinating quote, he said, "Let's fight to make sure that the arms merchants in our own country stop feeding the countless wars that rage across the globe." That was an extraordinary thing. Now, of course, as president, it's his enabling of those same arms merchants in our own country who are feeding the countless wars, including the war in Yemen that is being fought by Saudi Arabia with our weapons.
Yeah, it truly was extraordinary. You remember, I think it was last month that Obama went over to Saudi Arabia, and the coverage was kind of vague about what he was doing there. I suspected that it was part of this arms deal, and secondly, part of an effort to soothe the Saudi government fears when those heretofore undisclosed 28 pages were coming out, which showed a connection between elements of the Saudi Arabian monarchy and the terrorists that blew up the World Trade Center. I thought he was going over there for those two reasons. But what strikes me as so extraordinary is that the United States has Saudi Arabia as one of its main allies. And my question is going to be, why is that? Where at the same time, Saudi Arabia is such a hideous government. They behead people for sorcery. They spread this terrible ideology across the world. They have terror in their own country, where if you object to anything, you go to prison for 15 years if you're lucky. And this is a main ally of the United States. What is it about Saudi Arabia that the United States finds so compelling?
Well, there's a lot bound up in that question. I think that it's not a new phenomenon for the United States to have its closest allies include some of the worst human rights violators in the world. That's an old story. It was certainly common during the Cold War, but it didn't end with the Cold War. And what we see with countries like Saudi Arabia, it certainly isn't the only one, but it's one of the most egregious in so many human rights arenas, whether it's oppression of women, oppression of gay people, oppression of anyone who is not considered extreme enough in their own version of Wahhabi Islam. In all of those ways, Saudi Arabia remains hugely problematic in terms of human rights. That's never been the primary criteria for U.S. alliances, and it certainly isn't with Saudi Arabia. I think that the visit this year to Saudi Arabia probably did have something to do with the question of the Saudi role in September 11 attacks, but I think it was probably even more than the release of the 28 pages, which the Saudi government had said they were fine with the release of it, because as we know, those pages don't include a real smoking gun. It includes indications that a couple of low-ranking Saudi officials may have been involved with these guys, but they, I think, were quite careful to make sure that there was no one at a significantly higher decision-making level that could be linked to it from those documents. What I think they were more concerned about is the possibility that the U.S. may change its law that up until now has prohibited families of the victims of September 11 attacks from suing Saudi Arabia for collaboration in the deaths of their loved ones. The U.S. has taken the position that the Saudis are immune from such lawsuits in the United States. But in the recent period, with the talk about the 28 pages being released, there's been talk about maybe changing that position and maybe saying that the families of the 9/11 victims should be allowed to sue the Saudis in U.S. courts, something that the Saudis are very worried about. And I think that that may have been on the agenda as well as follow-up from the Iran nuclear deal, something that was very much on the agenda last year as well. The role that Saudi Arabia is playing both in supposedly participating in the global war on terror, while at the same time Saudi money, it's uncertain whether it comes from the royal family, from the government, from independent institutions, from wealthy Saudi individuals, but clearly from Saudi Arabia, money is going to ISIS, even while the Saudis say that they are participating in the so-called global war on terror. And what that means is they are helping in the arming and funding of rebel forces in Syria, for instance. There's a great deal of tension around all of those issues. So I think all of those things were on the agenda for President Obama's visit this year to Saudi Arabia.
Phyllis, I have a final question. Can you explain what the Defense Security Cooperation Agency is? They gave a statement saying that this proposed sale would contribute to the foreign policy and national security of this country by helping improve security of a strategic regional partner. Who are they?
They're one of the agencies that sort of links. It's a defense agency. It's connected to the Pentagon, but it also is connected to the State Department in terms of its claims to be concerned about U.S. diplomatic goals. So this whole question of approval for arms deals around the world is a very opaque process, deliberately so. It's designed to not be easily understood. It's designed not to be easily held accountable for decisions about who decides who gets access to U.S. military equipment. For example, in almost every arms sale, the U.S. imposes what they call end-use agreements, which basically says that the country that's buying these guns, these bombs, these bombers, these planes, these bullets, these cluster bombs, whatever it is, they agree that they will use those weapons only for very specific named conditions. They will use it only for self-defense. They will use it only within their own territory, whatever the conditions are. It's usually quite narrow. But the question then becomes, who's going to enforce that? You know, I would imagine, and I have not seen the documents, I would imagine that the weapons that are being sold to the Saudi Arabian government are being sold on the basis of they're needed to protect Saudi Arabia from the possibility of Iranian incursions, for instance. The tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia for regional hegemony goes back many years. So I would bet that there's some reference to that as the reason we are sending these horrific weapons to Saudi Arabia. When they go ahead and then use those weapons against civilians in Yemen, it may well be a violation of those end-use agreements, but that doesn't matter unless somebody holds them accountable. And if we can't really sort out easily who are the agencies, who are the people who are responsible, I mean, I think it is possible, but it takes a great deal of digging. I'm looking forward to reading Medea Benjamin's new book on the U.S.-Saudi relationship. I haven't had a chance yet, but I'm hoping that she sorts through some of that. I think that it's deliberately kept very opaque so that we can't hold somebody directly accountable for those violations.
Phyllis Bennis, as usual, it's a pleasure to have you on to help demystify some of these issues for us, and we look forward to more updates.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Phyllis, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
George W. Bush is now 70 years old and retired on his ranch outside of Crawford, Texas. Many Americans remember him as a clueless figure on the morning of 9/11 reading My Pet Goat to a classroom of children. They think of Bush as a hands-off leader who turned over the reins of power to his Vice President Dick Cheney, his Secretary of State Donald Rumsfeld, and the head of the CIA George Tenet. But the major decisions after 9/11, including the bombing of Afghanistan, the opening of the Guantanamo offshore prison camp, torture, and the introduction of the Patriot Act and the war on Iraq, were made by George W. Bush, who denominated himself as the decider. He had an unnerving level of certitude, as Gene Edward Smith, author of the recent expansive biography called Bush, has written. Smith writes that Bush firmly believed that he was the instrument of God's will. We speak with Professor Smith about his biography. Smith is the author of three previous biographies of presidents, Roosevelt, Eisenhower, and Grant, a nominee for the Pulitzer Prize, and a professor at the University of Toronto. Professor Gene Edward Smith, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Gene, I wanted to ask you something about George W. Bush's background. I know that he was the president of his fraternity house at Yale, and before that, he was the head cheerleader at his prep school at Andover, and then he came into the baseball business and owned a piece of the Texas Rangers, was the governor of Texas for a while. Talk to us about what you think his background was that made him the kind of president he was.
Well, I think he was always an underachiever, if you want. Unlike his father, who was a superb athlete and a fairly good scholar, George W. was not. He got into Yale because at the time when he was finishing Andover, near the bottom of his class, Yale was taking 52% of the legacy applicants. Harvard and Princeton at the time were taking about 14%. And Kingman Brewster became president of Yale during George's first year, changed the rules, Yale began to take the same legacy quotas as Princeton and Harvard. And so none of George's brothers or sisters got into Yale, although they had precisely the same legacy credentials as he did and better records. At Yale, Bush coasted through. He was a C student. Then he went back to Texas. In 73, he was admitted to Harvard Business School. It's my understanding that he is the only graduate of... He had 53 interviews with Fortune 500 companies, but did not receive one job offer. It's my understanding that he is the only graduate of Harvard Business School not to have received a job offer when he graduated. And one of his classmates told me they considered him to be dynamically ignorant. And I think that's probably describes him. He went back to Texas, went into the oil business, through family connections, profited through that, and helped his father in the campaign in 88, when his father ran against Mr. Dukakis. But in the late 80s, George sobered up. He became a born-again Christian, and he stopped drinking and stopped taking drugs. And from that point on, his life became fairly straight and narrow. But that doesn't change the fact that he was not very well educated.
After he became president, did he ever attend a National Security Council meeting?
He attended the first one in January of 01, and he said that he was much more concerned about domestic matters at that time. And he said Condoleezza Rice will chair these in my absence, and he did not attend another one until after 9/11. I think the National Security Council met 23 times in that period, and he didn't attend any of them. But he was much more concerned about domestic matters until 9/11.
One of the numbers that sticks in my head from looking at your book is that he received, up until 9/11, 44 different CIA briefs warning that al-Qaeda was up to something. And on August 6th, they pretty much spelled it out for him and Condoleezza Rice. What's your reaction to that?
He wasn't interested in it. He was more concerned about domestic matters. And this was something on the distant horizon. He was not concerned about foreign policy until 9/11, with one exception. And that exception has to do with North Korea. The Clinton administration, beginning in 1994, and South Korea were negotiating with North Korea to bring North Korea really back into the family of nations. There was a peace treaty with South Korea. The United States and South Korea were going to provide financial assistance for North Korea, and North Korea was going to cancel their nuclear weapons program. And Madeleine Albright went to Pyongyang in December of 2000, after the election but before the inauguration, to work on the deal. The South Korean president came to Washington in March of 2001, believing that they had a deal set. You may recall that's when Colin Powell got caught off base, when Colin Powell said they were going to do it, and he was caught short. Bush, that's the only major foreign policy issue that Bush considered before 9/11, and Bush blocked it. Bush did not want to deal with North Korea. He thought the North Koreans were evil and simply washed his hands of it.
Michael and I thought that it was really Dick Cheney who worked the reins of power, but in your book you document something entirely different. Who made the major strategy decisions after 9/11?
After 9/11, it was George W. Bush. Now, the point, when the administration took office in January 01, Cheney did play a very influential role. Cheney, with the exception of Colin Powell, don't forget he had been White House Chief of Staff under Gerald Ford. He had been Secretary of Defense under George Herbert Walker Bush and a member of Congress for 11 years. He knew Washington, whereas Bush didn't, and so Bush passed a lot of the responsibility off onto Cheney up until 9/11. But with 9/11, Bush took control as Commander-in-Chief, and indeed on 9/12, September 12th, Cheney met with him early that morning and suggested that Cheney chair a cabinet committee to organize policy and make recommendations to Bush. And Bush said no, he was a commander-in-chief, and he was going to do it. So I think in the beginning, Cheney did play an important role, but that eroded as time went on. And, of course, the Scuola-Libya affair caused it to erode much further.
Cheney wanted it, but he refused to grant Libby a pardon. Professor Smith, you write that Bush's decision to invade Iraq is easily the worst foreign policy decision ever made by an American president. And then you go on to say that that he believed he was an agent of God's will and acting with divine guidance. What must have been like for his staff and people around him to deal with a person that believed that he was an instrument of God's will and was stubborn?
Don't forget, he was the commander-in-chief in Washington. People salute the commander-in-chief and do his bidding. But let's go back to George Bush as God's agent. Becoming a born-again Christian reformed Bush personally. He stopped drinking. He stopped taking drugs. Began to lead a straight life, but it also gave him that feeling that he was later on that he was God's agent here on earth fighting evil. And if you believe you're God's agent fighting evil, there's really no holes barred. The reason I say that the Iraq decision was the decision to attack Iraq is the worst foreign policy decision, I was reminded of it when Mr. Trump suggested that President Obama and Mrs. Clinton were the founders of ISIS. George W. Bush is the founder of ISIS because by getting rid of Saddam Hussein, he left a vacuum there in which ISIS, Al-Qaeda and ISIS developed. So Saddam was a ruthless dictator, but he kept the lid on things like that.
Yeah, that was my reaction, too, when I read that in the book. Talk to us about enhanced interrogation techniques, torture, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib. What was the reaction of the generals and people around Bush when Bush insisted on making those policy decisions?
Well, let me separate the two, the enhanced interrogation techniques and the taking of prisoners and whatever. And the surveillance domestically. Again, if you believe you're God's agent and you're fighting evil, no holes are barred. And Bush was supported in that by the Office of Legal Counsel, which wrote gave him memos that supporting what he wanted to do. That was Professor John Yoo. Bush believed that he was fighting evil. And whether it was domestically or whether it was in foreign relations. And if you're fighting evil, as I said earlier, no holes are barred. The generals, on the other hand, were not that enthusiastic about it. And let's go to Iraq just for a moment. The generals and the Pentagon assumed that they were going into Iraq, that they were going to remove Saddam Hussein, find whatever weapons of mass destruction that were there, and leave within 90 days. And then on the flight deck of the Abraham Lincoln, you may recall, that's where Bush spoke under the banner that said mission accomplished. Bush changed the policy. Bush said, we're going to bring democracy to Iraq. We're going to become occupiers. The military, and Rumsfeld as well, had assumed that they were going in just to be liberators. And Bush said they were going to be occupiers. And really, everything fell out at that point.
You interviewed Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld for this book. What was that like?
Oh, I interviewed both of them many times, and I'm sort of the same age that they are. So, and we've known each other for some time. So that went fine. I thought that they were quite cooperative.
Unlike George W. Bush, who declined to speak with you.
Well, that's right. Cheney set up an interview for me with George W. Bush, and just before I was to go out, I got a telephone call from one of his aides who said that the president doesn't want to see you because you wrote a book critical of his father, which I did. In 1992, I published a book called George Bush's War, critical of the first Bush's decision to attack Iraq, and for that reason, he didn't want to see me. Taking that at face value, there may have been other reasons too, but I don't know what they were.
How would you evaluate Bush as president, say, compared to other people who you know quite a lot about, Grant or Eisenhower?
Well, now, both Grant and Eisenhower and Roosevelt are in the top category of presidents, and Bush is in the bottom. I don't think Bush was the worst president. I think Herbert Hoover pretty much has a lock on that. That doesn't mean that his decision to go into Iraq was I still believe that was the worst foreign policy decision any president ever made. But if you look domestically, Bush did good things domestically. Some, no child left behind, that there are problems with it, but it recognized the fact that standards had to be applied. Prescription drugs for seniors is important. Overseas, Bush led the fight against AIDS, and I think has turned the corner on it in Africa. With foreign trade, the United States had free trade agreements only with three countries, Italy, Mexico, and Canada, when Bush took office. When he left office, we had free trade agreements with 16 countries. And I think his handling of the financial downturn in 2008 was exceptional. I think by 2008, I think he realized maybe that he wasn't God's agent here on earth and that he had messed up. And so when the financial downturn came, he listened to Hank Paulson, his Secretary of the Treasury, and Ben Bernanke, and took actions that really were contrary to his personal beliefs to arrest the downturn.
Our program, Law and Disorder, was started by me and Heidi and the late Michael Ratner, who was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, about a dozen years ago. And one of the things we started to cover right away, because it just so shocked and upset us, was first the Patriot Act and then the Military Order Number 1. As a student of American history, what did you think of those two measures?
The Patriot Act, again, is one of those measures that was ran through Congress. In fact, there were no hearings held on it. The administration rammed it through. The public debate simply wasn't there at the time, and people were not prepared to question what Bush was doing at the time. As I recall, there was only one dissent in the House against the Patriot Act, one negative vote, and that was a terrible piece of legislation that was passed. People in the United States didn't really question what Bush was doing in 2002 and 2003, and that was a very serious problem. I think later they did. I think that was true. You mentioned Abu Ghraib. We all saw the photos of the mistreatment of prisoners at Abu Ghraib, and we're all shocked by it. But I don't think what we really know or what we really knew at the time is that the reason the guards were acting that way is because the CIA and military intelligence told them to rough up the prisoners before they were being interrogated. Does that answer it?
Certainly does.
Well, Professor Smith, you've been called the greatest living biographer, and it has been truly an honor to have you on.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to be on.
Well, we've been speaking with Gene Edward Smith about his book just out called Bush, a great book. We urge everybody to pick it up and spend some time reading it and studying it. You'll profit by having done that. Thank you so much, Gene Edward Smith, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org. On the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.